This is Bob Lang with the Oral History Project of the University of Wisconsin at Madison. Today is February 14th, 2007. This interview is with Professor Christopher Coe, a member of the Department of Psychology and director of the Harlow Primate Laboratory. Chris, to begin the interview, if for the record, you would let us know when and where you were born and tell us a bit about who your parents were and your early growing up years and what the first decade of school was like.
I was born in 1951 in New York City. The specific part of New York was the borough of the Bronx. My parents were first-generation Americans. My father was the first and only a member of his family to go to college, and so that obviously had some influence on the importance of education in my family, which was highly emphasized as I was growing up. It was considered, like for many, the route to success in America. So with regards to the first 10 years, school was a highly valued part of the day, and it was expected that both my brother, I have one brother, and I would do well at school, and that would become a part of our lives, and in fact it did, since both of us ended up becoming university professors.
Now, were your parents immigrants?
No, my grandparents were immigrants on both sides. They were part of the large wave of immigrants that came to the States in the 1890s, early 1900s. But both my father and my mother were born here.
And what did your father do?
My father, coincidentally, or maybe not so coincidentally, had gone up to a master's in psychology, which he ended up not really using much in terms of actual clinical practice. He ended up becoming a civil service worker for the state of New York within the Department of Labor.
And your mother?
My mother, as was common in that time period, was a homemaker, housewife. I mean, she had part-time jobs, but she certainly wouldn't have described herself as a career woman, other than in the sense that she ran the household.
Now, it was clear to you and your brother from early on that education was particularly important?
It was certainly emphasized as, it was without question that we would do well in school. I mean, in terms of what we would ultimately do with it, our aspirations beyond college, that was always left up to us. But it was certainly pretty evident to us from early on, when you ask about the first 10 years of our lives, that it was an expectation we would have been a disappointment if we didn't at least make it to college. And in fact, both of us in the end made it through PhDs and beyond.
Now, are you the oldest of
you and
your
brother?
I'm the younger. Now, did you go to the New York City public schools or private?
I was educated throughout elementary school, middle school, high school, in the public schools, and then even at the college level. In New York, they have something called the City University System, which is not so dissimilar from the University of Wisconsin. And so my undergraduate degree was from City College of New York.
Are there any significant teachers at the elementary, middle school level before we start talking about high school?
None that I remember by name, although as I started to say that, of course, I did remember one by name. Probably the most significant event, which was probably also the most traumatic event, when I was in academically traumatic event, was when my seventh grade English teacher made us read Homer's The Iliad from line one to the very end. And I remember that being an epiphany. The accomplishment of surviving through the Iliad made me realize that you could get through just about any text.
That might have stood you in good stead years later. And so then you go on to high school in the Bronx somewhere, I assume. Mm-hmm. What was that like? This would have been in the mid-60s, I suppose.
It would have been early 60s, yeah.
Early 60s.
New York, especially at that time, had a sort of a school strategy where they would promote you if they thought you were, accelerate you if they thought you were doing well. So I ended up skipping two grades, and so I actually got through high school by 16 years of age, whereas typically it's 18, like now. So high school for me was a little out of the ordinary in the sense that I was quite a bit younger than any of my peers.
Did you skip freshman and sophomore year?
Well, actually, the skipping was earlier. I was very precocious. I skipped kindergarten because I was already reading, which enabled me to jump to first grade, and then I skipped the eighth grade in middle school. But that enabled me to get to high school 2 years ahead of my the typical chronological age.
I see. So you had a full 4 years in high school?
Yeah. It just, when you ask what was high school like, high school was a little unique because I was 2 years younger than anybody else.
Yeah.
And this particular school was a very large all-male school with 3,000 guys. So to be 2 years younger than your contemporaries in a school where I was 13 on entrance and the ones who were graduating seniors were 18, or if they had been held back, some were 19, even 20. So high school was a unique experience because of that age discrepancy.
Yeah. What was it like? Was it aversive?
Oh, I was quite different than many of the kids. I mean, not just because of age, but again, different from now. At that time, tracking was considered totally appropriate and reasonable, and so there was an honors curriculum, and then there was the rest of the curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was, not surprisingly, tracked into the honors path, and so I was not only younger, but I was sort of in this sort of academically elite group of classes and with other kids who were like that, as opposed to the rest of the school. So it's different than now, where we're much more concerned about equality and equal opportunity, which doesn't always pan out, but we're at least concerned about it, and so there's much more mixing of kids. Certainly as I think of my own children being reared in Madison, it's quite different now.
Yeah.
We don't track kids from early on, and we would be very concerned. I mean, although we have, you know, certain kinds of classes in our high schools which are considered the advanced placement, it's not quite the same as it was back then, where you could have a whole group of kids who were segregated into an honors curriculum the way I was.
I'm interested that it was an all-boy high school, and that was part of the public school system?
Yeah, and actually, as it turned out in my case, I was in an all-boys middle school as well, so from 7th grade on through until I got to college, I was in an all-boys school, and they had sister schools, both for the middle school as well as for the high school, that were the companion school for the girls.
I'm curious, this is a digression, but as you look back on it, do you think that was a good system? Did you get a good education, pre-college education that way?
Oh, I think from an educational point of view, it actually worked out quite well, and even now, you know, there's a lot of discussion and debate about the potential benefits of having the boys and girls separate for a period of time. It certainly increased our interest in the other sex, though.
Yeah.
Certainly by the time I was, I got to college, I was definitely primed to think about the other sex.
Did you, during high school, begin to envision yourself as an intellectual? Did you think of yourself as more than just a smart boy?
Well, I certainly didn't have any vision of where I was going by high school. I mean, I knew that, as I said earlier, that education was very important, and I certainly did well grade-wise in high school, but I certainly couldn't have told you that one day I would be a college professor, or for that matter, even one day I'd be a professional. It was like with many kids, I was just much more focused on getting through my classes, my tests, and the day and all of that. I wasn't looking forward 10 years out, and quite frankly, even through most of college, I really didn't have, I wasn't somebody who early on was able to say, oh, well, one day I want to be a researcher or a college professor. That came later when I reached graduate school.
Chris, still in high school though, are you finding some courses more interesting than others that relate to your eventual prominence as a researcher and working in psychology?
No, I would probably have described myself more as a jewel in the rough. I certainly did well in high school, and that was true even in science classes. As my mother would remind me years later, my chemistry teacher told me I should go into chemistry, which I didn't. I didn't have any early sense that I would make a career in science. And I probably, if you had asked me as a 16-year-old, I probably would have said no. If you had asked me at that age, I probably would have guessed that I would have ended up more in the social sciences. And so maybe that is how it is that I found myself in psychology, which is in a bridge profession between the social and the biological sciences.
Did living in New York City affect who you became? I mean, this capital of the world with so many riches and museums and things to do. Were you all over the city, you and your brother, when you were growing up?
My brother's 6 years older, so although we were close, it wasn't that we ran around the city together, because there was enough of an age difference that he was taking me as the big brother. But certainly with friends and with girlfriends, New York was a fantastic place to grow up. It was a playground, unlike growing up in a small city where you wonder what to do Friday night or on Saturday. I mean, New York is sort of endless in its opportunities. So that was everything from museums to movies to just people watching downtown. So I have very fond memories of New York. I still like big cities. I go back. And it did include also trips to the Museum of Natural History and trips to the Bronx Zoo, which, if you're looking for formative events, early experiences that may have shaped how it is that I found myself to monkeys and animals and biological research, certainly on many occasions, probably at a minimum once a year, I found my way into the Museum of Natural History, and ended up actually working there part-time as a college student, as a sort of after-school job. And growing up in the Bronx, there's a very big and famous zoo in the Bronx, which was not that far from where I grew up. Despite, called the Bronx Zoo, appropriately enough. And so despite the fact that I was a city kid, I had ready access to seeing animals and seeing the elephants, seeing the gorillas and all of that certainly must have played some role in why I am where I am.
So you're in high school and you're finishing in 4 years and you're going to graduate, and there's no question about you're going to college, I gather, from your parents' expectations. How did you pick City College of New York? Did you look around?
Well, not only was there no question about me going to college, but there was also no question about which college I would go to, because at that time, City College of New York was essentially free. It was a free university. There was a nominal $37 registration fee that you paid, but everything else was tuition free. And it was such a bargain that it was certainly hard for my family, who were not that well-to-do, to turn down. And its reputation in that day, and certainly the generation before, was it was the poor man's Harvard, was how it was described. And my father had gone there, and so that was his alma mater. And it was just assumed that both my brother and I would go there for college. Subsequently, when we both went to graduate school, we went on to other places. But college, it was just a given that we would go to one of the branches of the City University, which in this case, in my case, it was City College.
Now, was it difficult to get in?
You didn't have to test into it, but you did have to have a certain grade point average. And just like now, they had exams, the equivalent of the SATs. I'm not sure they were called SATs back then, but it was the equivalent of that kind of an SAT, ACT exam. And so But as I said, I did reasonably well in high school, and so it really wasn't, it was sort of a no-brainer. It was just assumed that I would go on from high school to that particular college.
So you must have entered in the fall of 67.
That is correct.
Then. Was City College experiencing turmoil related to the culture of the times, the Vietnam War and so forth?
Yeah, as was Madison at that time.
Yes.
New York was caught up in the throes of, I came in just towards the tail end of the Civil Rights Movement, but right in the heyday of what became the anti-war movement. So, yes, the university college was closed down repeatedly. There were large demonstrations. It was both an interesting and a crazy time to be in college.
And what was college like for you?
Well, again, I was in early, so I was in college by 16 and a half, so again,
yes,
there was this age difference, and it, I would say it was a wonderful experience, an eye-opening experience, but certainly not like the more quiet times we live in now. I mean, there were demonstrations on a regular basis. The university was, it seemed like we including me, were protesting everything as we look back, as I look back on it, not just the war, but if somebody wanted to change the layout of the gardens, if somebody wanted to change parts of the curriculum, if there was a movement called Open Admissions. So despite the fact that it was a free university, you still had to test in, as you asked about. But we decided that it would be progressive at that time, that anyone who wanted to go to college should be allowed to go. So we pushed for a ban on all entrance requirements, which we actually won. We shut the university down for a semester until they caved in, and they created what was called the Open Admissions Program. Anybody who wanted to go to college in New York was allowed to go. That turned out to be a very ill-conceived and misguided change, and it was reversed probably about 15 years ago. But for a period of time, there were both protests to create that change and then the initiation of that change, which was just an egalitarian opening of the doors to anybody who wanted to go to college. I mean, the problem was obviously if many of the kids who then came in really weren't prepared for college. They really needed to have sort of backfill makeup classes, and there was all sorts of resentment about that. But anyway, so there was a lot of tumult and
yes,
chaos, but at the same time, it was a very interesting time to go to college.
Was it your experience that, in fact, it was the poor man's Harvard? Were the professors good? Was the work rigorous?
Looking back on it from my position today, I wouldn't go quite that far.
Uh-huh.
And say it was the equivalent of Harvard, or for that matter, even the equivalent of the University of Wisconsin. But it was certainly more than good enough. There was unevenness, I guess, is looking back on it. There were some outstanding faculty, and there still are at the City College of New York. But there were also some who were not so outstanding. The class size was large, which is not uncommon. I don't ever remember a seminar, a small class.
Mm-hmm.
So I wouldn't say it was truly Harvard, but for $37 a semester, it was one heck of a bargain. And for many poor kids, it was the only way they could go to college.
Did you live at home or on campus?
It was much more common in New York, whereas here in Madison it would not be common to do that. But in New York, it was not uncommon to live at home. And so I lived at home for the first year. Through the beginning of my sophomore year, and then moved out. Well, actually, I temporarily dropped out of school in my sophomore year, but then when I came back, I lived in an apartment
uh-huh.
with a roommate.
Uh-huh. Now, you were a anthropology major with a biology minor. How did you come to those selections?
Well, as I said earlier, I didn't have a crystal ball in the beginning that
guided me in a certain direction. In fact, I bounced all over the curriculum. Before I was an anthropology major, I dabbled in art for a while.
Studio art,
primarily because of this girl who was an art major, who I followed around from class to class until one of the art professors looked at my free drawings one day and said, "You're not planning on making a career." At which point I moved on. I continued to take art classes, but moved on to other things, including minoring in biology and majoring in anthropology.
And why anthro? What was it about anthropology?
You asked about inspired teachers, actually. There were a few really charismatic anthropology teachers who turned me on to the subject matter. In particular, one who was what we would call a biological anthropologist today. Back then, they called it physical anthropology. Oh. It was the study of human evolution, the study of our relatives. And he was actually the one who first got me started in the direction that I ended up working in, which was to study monkeys, study aspects of biology that are similar between us and animals.
So it was the power of the teacher caught your interest?
Yeah, I basically stumbled backwards into some anthropology classes just out of curiosity. And then early on, there was this one charismatic teacher who really turned me on to the subject matter. And then as I took more anthropology classes, I'm looking back, I'm not sorry I majored in anthropology, because other teachers were equally interesting and charismatic in other branches of anthropology, even as far as linguistics and cultural anthropology, archaeology. So looking back on it, I think I got a great liberal arts education by majoring in anthro.
Did you have many distribution requirements? Like, did you have to do foreign language and humanities?
That was typical at that time period. It was only later, I think, that universities began to abandon that. No, so at that point you had to pick, you know, sort of a smorgasbord. You had to pick one class from this set, one class from that set. So it included 2 years of language, it included science classes, math classes, you had social science classes, you had to take a sampling, you even had to take required physical education classes for 4 semesters. Personally, I don't think it would be a mistake to go back to that. I think some of the loosening up that we've done has actually been a disservice to kids, and a little bit more structure wouldn't hurt this generation. I have 2 children, one who was an engineering major and one who took more of a mixed liberal arts education. And I personally think from the point of view of college, having a more diversified set of classes where you sample things before you get locked in, for many kids, that's the better education.
Let me ask you one thing about CCNY. Was that limited to kids who lived in New York City, or could you be an outstate New Yorker and come?
I would imagine it was comprised largely of the children of New York, not because it was a requirement, just because it may not have even been known to people outside of New York, but I'm pretty sure that if you had the right grades, you could have matriculated in, certainly from the outer suburbs around New York. But I'm going to guess that even a foreign student or a student from another state could have come there. I don't know if they would have gotten the same bargain of a $37 a semester rate, but it probably had the equivalent of an in-state, out-of-state tuition.
I see. Now, you graduate with honors from City College in 1971. What were you going to do then? Did you know you were going on to graduate school?
It's probably good for students now to hear that I still did not have a crystal ball or a sense of where I was headed. I had a somewhat of a unusual transition to graduate school, which was that I graduated after a fall semester in mid-year, and there was a new graduate program opening up at a school in Brooklyn, and they were short of warm bodies, and the director of that program, I went to interview there thinking I might apply for the following year, and he said, if you're willing to come on Monday, you can come to graduate school next week. And so I took my last final on a Friday as an undergrad, and on Monday of the following week, I was a graduate student in graduate school. So it was one of those opportunity knocks. I mean, obviously, I had to have the right grades and all of that to get in, but since I had the right grades, I literally fell backwards into graduate school.
Oh, interesting. Now, that's the Downstate Medical Center of the State University of New York.
Correct.
And that was in Brooklyn?
Brooklyn.
Uh-huh. So you were admitted to the medical school, but not in medicine, I take it.
It was a very interesting program that was way ahead of its times. There really isn't anything quite equivalent to it today. It wouldn't hurt if we had something like it. What they decided at the time, these were faculty from the medical school, they decided that it would be interesting to create PhDs who went through the med school curriculum, but not to get an MD, not to practice medicine, but to be conversant with medical ideas to do biomedical research. But you would still be a PhD, so I took med school classes, I took seminars, obviously I ended up a PhD, but it was through the med school at this Downstate Medical Center, and it was primarily the faculty from anatomy and psychiatry who ran the program. And for a period of time, for about 15 years, they ran this program, and then it came to an end. Today, the closest we would have to something like that might be a neurosciences program, but even that's not really the same, because a neurosciences graduate student would not take med school classes, whereas I really took psychiatry and physiology and anatomy with the med students.
Did you give any thought to getting an MD degree as well?
Quite a few of the students in the program did along the way decide to do an MD-PhD program. That we have. We do have MD-PhD programs now.
Uh-huh.
And there were a number of students who started as PhDs who topped off by then going back to med school. But in my case, I just finished the PhD component of the program, got a PhD, went on to a postdoc. But it certainly had a huge influence on me and enabled me to do much more medical research than is common, and always in my research to think about that side of it. So what is the medical relevance? What's the clinical relevance?
Yeah.
So even when I do a basic science study in animals, more than most, I'm always asking myself, well, so how does that apply to people? I mean, what disease is it relevant to? So
yes.
For example, I do research on anemia now. I do research on flu, which is not something that is standard in a psychology department.
Uh-huh.
And I would say I probably have the most clinical experience of any of the psych faculty in my department, and do more clinically oriented research. Not clinical psychology research, but clinically oriented.
Yes.
Towards diseases. I had a 5-year grant on chronic pain patients, for example. We just submitted a grant involving cancer patients. So I even now do much more biomedical research because of that PhD program.
Yes, it's almost like you don't question the value of your research being utilized for immediate gain.
I hope it has some value and gain.
Well, I mean, you are a basic researcher, but you seem to be very interested, and perhaps it's due to your graduate training, in utilizing it to treat a variety of illnesses.
I hope it's not remote. Obviously, there are some basic science studies where we don't know their relevance for a generation, but
right.
I hope mine don't take that long to have some bearing. I mean, even when it's just general knowledge, if one were to read my more clinically oriented papers, there's always some piece of it where it ends with, and this will inform us about whatever that is, fetal development, cancer, you know, relationships between the brain and the immune system, whatever. So I credit that graduate program with giving me that perspective.
This concludes side one of tape one. This is side two of tape one, Professor Christopher Coe. Chris, it seems like you were clearly tracked, as it were, for a career in research then, by entering this program.
I was. If you would again have asked me at the time, at the age of 21, did I know where I was headed, I would have not been able to tell you. But certainly the goal of the faculty of that program was to create a generation of academics and researchers.
Uh-huh.
And most of us did. Certainly the ones who finished the program went on to stay in research and academics. They knew more than I did about where I was headed.
Significant faculty in your graduate program.
Yeah, by the time we're at the graduate level, now there are very clear people who had an influence. One was this director I mentioned who welcomed me into the program in an unusual way, essentially just opening the door.
His name?
Walter Riss. What I'm going to mention about him is not, I mean, there were intellectual things that were very important as well in terms of what he taught us, but what was most impressive to us as graduate students, young graduate students, was that he had a photographic memory and could remember every article that he had ever read, but not just the content. He actually could tell you the authors, the year, the title, the journal, page numbers, he would do that just to impress us, but it then became a competition amongst all the first and second year graduate students to be able to keep up with it and do it as well. And so, and in fact, in that time period, you know, we had comprehensive exams and prelim exams, and the way it was done in that time period was they would lock you in a room for a day or two at a time, handwriting. We didn't have computers. So you would handwrite, and when you were locked in there, you were also not allowed to bring in any reference material. You had to memorize or anything you would cite, and so a component of the program was to be like this Professor Riss, and to not only handwrite out these answers for 10, 20 pages at a time, but to actually have memorized verbatim the author's year, journal, page numbers, issue numbers of any citation you would then use on the exam. And to this day, that sort of scholarliness is important to me, somewhat to the dismay of my undergrads and graduate students, when I expect that it's not a bad idea to be able to remember in what year this person worked or in what time period that article was. I don't make them remember the page numbers the way we tried to, but it certainly impressed me that knowing that aspect of history and scholarship was an important thing.
That kind of rigor has made a difference in your intellectual career, I take it.
It was a kind of a precision and an attention to detail and an appreciation of, if I see further, I stand on the shoulders of giants, because every had a history to it, and it had citations to an earlier generation. And
yes.
To this day, I still like going to the stacks, and I like the smell of old books, and I will even now track a reference down that might be from 1900, as opposed to looking for the PDF file that's only 5 years old.
Uh-huh.
I will march myself over to, well, now it's on the other side of campus, the Health Sciences Library, and go into the stacks and find a JAMA from 1905 to read the original, or in this case, since I'm studying flu, to read a 1919 journal article on the big pandemic from 1918.
Yes.
Whereas the younger generation, the current generation of students, if an article is more than 5 years old, if they can't get it as a PDF file, it's sort of lost to them. So I credit this particular man with having impressed upon us the value of that kind of scholarship, and in fact to have turned it into a game. It was, a competition amongst us in his seminars.
Yes.
To be able to act like him. He was our sort of our role model.
Other key faculty.
having said that, all these wonderful things about him, I actually started in this fellow's lab, and he assigned me a project that I came to hate. His particular research was on how does pain get up to the brain, and at the time we didn't know all the pathways that the sensation of pain made its way through, navigating its way up the spinal cord. And so my assignment was, there was this poor woman who had died of cancer, but they had her spinal cord, and my job was to section in incredibly thin slices, 25 micron thin slices, her entire spinal cord, and to stain each slice with a different color, a different type of stain. And I would do that every 5 slices, and then I would start over with the same color, the same stain again. And I got a few inches up this woman's cord, staining these pathways, and said, if this is what science is all about, it's not for me. It wasn't what I thought. It wasn't very grand. It was pretty mundane and repetitive. And rather than drop out of the program, they allowed me to switch into a different person's lab. And this second individual, a man named Leonard Rosenblum, worked with monkeys. And that had sort of been in the background from my undergraduate years, and anthropology. And he was interested in development and behavior of monkeys, the effects of early rearing on brain development, behavioral development. And so I switched in my second year of graduate school into this fellow's lab, Leonard Rosenblum, and then ended up staying with him and did my dissertation with him. Which brings me full circle to where we are sitting now, because coincidentally, he had been a graduate student with Harry Harlow at the University of Wisconsin. And so it was sort of an academic legacy through Len, through Leonard Rosenblum, that I would one day make my way back to this very chair that I'm sitting in. It took a while. I didn't know I would end up finding my way here. It was another 15 years later after first transferring into Len's lab, but it explains how I found my way here. So when I switched to work with monkeys in my second year of graduate school, it set in motion all the events that explain why we're sitting here and having this chat today.
Now, it's fascinating. It's absolutely fascinating. Professor Rosenblum, was he a student of Harry Harlow?
He was a graduate student of Harry Harlow. He got his PhD here in 1960, sort of in the heyday of Harry Harlow's fame. And so after getting his PhD, he joined the psychiatry department at Downstate Medical Center in New York. And then in the early 1970s, I joined his lab. And in a sense, he's passing on. And I never really met Harry Harlow, but in a real way, he was my academic grandfather, with quotation marks on it.
The field of research utilizing monkeys, was it growing exponentially at this point? Or was it still a relatively new field?
It had just hit the exponential phase that you're talking about. It was still relatively new, in the sense of this was the time when Jane Goodall was in Africa first studying chimpanzees.
Yes.
There were people first studying the other great apes, the gorilla. There was a lot of interest in what could we learn about the human condition from studying monkeys. So it had just hit, I would say, the late 60s, the early 70s, when I joined the field, was when it hit that exponential phase that you're referring to. Now it's actually shrinking, but it did continue to grow all through the 70s, 80s, but by the 90s it sort of peaks, and now it's diminishing some from that period, that 20-year period.
Did you feel, once you joined Dr. Rosenblum's lab, that you had found an intellectual home? Were you really engaged?
I would say that was... up until now, I've been denying that there was any path or trajectory, and that it was much more circumstance and coincidence, but by the second year of graduate school, certainly by the third year, I had found my interest area, my niche. I couldn't have told you where I would end up, but I certainly was now committed. I knew I would get a PhD. I knew that I would go on. I knew that I wanted to be a part of academics and research by the second to third year of graduate school.
What is your PhD dissertation, and how soon do you start working on that?
I always had an interest in nature and nurture, and to what extent we're controlled by our biology, by our genes, and to what extent we're plastic, malleable, that we can change in different contexts, different environments. And so my dissertation focused on the degree to which social dominance and aggression in monkeys could be turned on or turned off by the environment or situation in which you studied them, evaluated them. So was it possible to, for example, to take two monkeys and have them be the best friends on one day, even in an alliance, a social alliance, and literally by the next morning, by putting them in a different context, a more competitive context, evoke, elicit from seemingly nowhere aggressiveness, contention, and the answer is yes. So that's what the dissertation focused on, was the malleability of social behavior depending upon the environment in which you evaluate two individuals, in this case, male monkeys.
That strikes me as a very major piece of work. That would have been a big dissertation. Was it?
Yeah, you know, some articles go into the literature and drop like a stone. It could have been, if I knew how to pitch it better. It got published, but it didn't have quite the influence, probably because I didn't know how to sell research that when I was that young, so it was published. And it just was an article, one of many hundreds of articles in the literature. I teach a class on primate behavior, and I still talk about that study, because I think the message is just as relevant today, as we look at our world around us, and we see Shiites and Sunnis who a few years back might have been neighbors, friends, intermarried, now suddenly in a different context find themselves in an explosive situation where they're willing to kill one another. Yes. And we don't have to just look to Iraq for that. So I think the message of how quickly different racial groups, religious groups, families can be split asunder or come back together, I think that message is still as important today as it was back then. And as a consequence, I talk about my dissertation briefly. I mean, I only subject them to about 15 minutes of my dissertation in class today. But the students still find that story interesting, and the sort of the storyline of the conclusions of that series of studies.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Now, when did you start? You got your PhD in 1976. How many years was that dissertation in process?
Well, it was standard at that time for, and it's probably not unusual today, for it to about a two-year process.
Uh-huh.
So you spent about a year to a year and a half doing the work. The write-up back then was different than now. It took much longer. We didn't have computers to do all our statistics instantly. So there were some days where I might come in at 9 in the morning and sit and do one long statistical test by hand. And by 5 o'clock, if you were lucky, if you hadn't made a calculation error, you were done with your analysis of variance or whatever it was you were working on. And so it took a while. Data analysis was a much more tedious, drawn-out process, whereas now you hit a button and literally 30 seconds later, that same test would be done for you. So it took longer. And then the write-up was much longer again because you didn't have a computer. So you either wrote it out longhand, or if you happened to work in a rich lab, you dictated it, and then there would be a secretary. But either way, either whether it was written out longhand or you dictated, then you would pass this on to a secretary, usually these fantastic women typists who could type 60, 70 words a minute. So every aspect of the process was just so much more extended. Whereas now, as I like to kid the students, I have 10 secretaries, all 10 fingers. Every professor had a secretary back then. The departments provided secretaries, and then many of them would have a second one. If they had grants, they would have a second secretary working for them. And so my professor had a full-time secretary, whereas today, I'd have to be very famous and very rich to have a full-time secretary.
What else is going on intellectually with you while you're working on the PhD? Are you taking other courses? Are you developing other interests?
Well, as we spoke about earlier, because of this strong medical curriculum that I was taking, although I was working on what today we'd call animal behavior, ethological kinds of questions, social psych kinds of questions, my own interests were getting more and more biological, and that influenced the kind of postdoc that I went to. And so when I left downstate, I went to Stanford Medical School, and there my intent was to learn more about physiology, and in particular the endocrine system. And so my postdoc advisor was an expert on the topic of stress, and in particular one kind of hormone that's secreted from the adrenal gland, cortisol, which is a stress responsive one. So what happens in that last year of graduate school is I realized that, well, what I really need to learn now is how to do more biomedical research. And so at that point, I segue into what becomes much more physiological research on the topic of stress, still with animals, but now focusing on stress physiology rather than a big picture question like, why are we aggressive and how can you change aggression?
And is that what led you to Stanford, because they had the best people?
Well, the best person. And as often happened then, and still happens to a certain degree now, it was done sort of with a handshake, meaning that my professor knew this professor at Stanford and sort of says, well, I have a good student. Do you have a fellowship opening? And I was sort of just passed on from one to the next.
So this Professor Rosenblum is quite critical for your development.
I think that the way I described it, I think, was quite common in that time period, which was that there would be, if you will, a letter of introduction. I mean, it wasn't that formal. This wasn't the Victorian era where you literally walked with a true letter of introduction. But your faculty advisor really opened the door for you. And without their recommendation and support, it would have been very difficult to move on to the next level. And that happens to some degree now.
And who was this key professor at Stanford?
So his name was Seymour Levine. He was a psychologist working in the psychiatry department out there, and his area of expertise was stress. Stress and this particular hormone from the adrenal, cortisol, he did, up until I got there, all of his research was done with rodents. He had decided he would like to expand his lab to work with primates. I was the young PhD who had gotten his dissertation done with primates, with monkeys, and so it was an academic marriage. I bring in the expertise on monkeys and how to run a monkey lab. He in turn teaches me how to do research on behavioral endocrinology.
Now, had you ever been west from New York before?
I mentioned just in passing that I had dropped out of college in my sophomore year, and that was not to do anything glorious, although maybe it was glorious. It was to go be a ski bum in Colorado.
Oh. I'm glad we have this.
So I spent I spent the winter skiing in Vail and Aspen in Colorado. So yeah, I had been west before. And I had traveled at the time to California and around the West Coast, so I knew the West Coast, but just recreationally. I had never done anything professionally in California, and Stanford was then, as it is now, an absolutely beautiful campus, and I knew it was the route to success. I mean, I knew that by being a postdoc at Stanford, that was something special, and so I was hungry for that. I mean, it wasn't just this letter of introduction and a pat on the back. When that opportunity came up to be able to be a postdoc at Stanford, that was special. I mean, that was something I really wanted to do.
Okay, and aside from the intellectual possibilities, it opened the door to major professional opportunities for you.
Yeah, I mean, California was a wonderful place to live. Stanford was a beautiful campus. Stanford was then already a famous campus, and I saw it as a real academic step up to be working in a Stanford lab as a postdoc.
Yeah.
And that still is true. People even now, even all these years later, will, if I'm being introduced somewhere and someone's tracing my academic history, will mention, oh, and he was at Stanford from 1976 to 1985. I mean, the Stanford part is like Harvard or whatever. It's an imprimatur of some, you acquire some spin from that university.
Yes.
I mean, University of Wisconsin does it too, to a certain degree, but the Ivies and Stanford do it a little more.
Yes. So what happens in that year as a postdoc?
Well, actually, the year as a postdoc ended up extending to 9 years. I enjoyed being at Stanford so much that rather than just finish up my 1 or 2 year postdoc, I liked being in the lab. I liked living in Palo Alto. And so I ended up staying on in a scientist track in that lab, in that department, and slowly worked my way up the hierarchy of titles from postdoc to research associate. And by the time I left at the end of 9 years, was what they would call an assistant professor for research, a research assistant professor in the Department of Psychiatry.
Okay, so you're in the Department of Psychiatry working, and are you with your degree, you have a PhD in psychology?
Well, it's an unusual PhD. It's whatever it is. It's a PhD in biological psychology from a med school. So it's not a typical degree. So it's neither psychology, nor is it straight biology, nor is it an MD degree. The name of the program was biological psychology. So what I put down on my CV and on my bio sketch is the truth. It's a PhD in biological psychology.
Now, during this time at Stanford, are you primarily a researcher or are you doing some teaching too?
I dabbled in teaching. It wasn't a requirement. The expectation was that my salary would be raised off of research grants, which they were. So that turned out to be very important as well, because during that 9 year period, I really mastered the business of grant writing, which then became very important once I got to UW. It gave me that extra time to get good at it, because often graduate students just benefit from the grants that their professors have but don't actually have any experience in writing them. Where I learned how to write a grant was during that time. And I've had a very charmed, lucky academic career, and just as I described the lucky coincidence of how I got into graduate school, my luck continued on with a very interesting and inspired decision the psychiatry department made at that time at Stanford, which was they thought, wouldn't it be an interesting structure to create if for all of the famous, really big name professors in our department, the senior ones, if we created a junior faculty member who would work with them in their labs. So for four of the more famous professors at the time, they created faculty lines, one of which I got, to be an assistant professor in the lab of this more famous guy, to sort of learn the ropes, to also help them, and all of that. And it wasn't just that one lab, it was done in several of the labs. There was a sleep lab and another lab where they did the same thing. And again, I would say it's a shame that those kinds of unique, creative, alternative paths don't exist now. We still have famous people and big-name people who have junior scientists working with them, but they don't get academic titles like assistant professor. They're called research associates, scientists, but they don't actually get what I got, which was I truly had an academic title. I was an assistant professor, but in this unique relationship with a more senior.
And this was with Professor Levine?
Yeah. Again, that didn't continue on at Stanford. I don't think I've ever encountered that type of structure set up at another university. We have at our university, the equivalent of that is the assistant scientist line. I have a woman working with me who's an assistant scientist, but she's not a faculty member. She is what she is. She's an assistant scientist, whereas I was able to go one step past that in this assistant professor for research track.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting, very productive time. While I was there, there were 9 PhD level people in that man's lab. That was already unbelievable that his lab was that big. Again, it created this very creative, competitive environment. 1 year, we published 50 articles, the 9 of us. He got his name on all 50, but it was this intense think tank environment. We were all working on our own projects. Very exciting, very stimulating situation, way to kind of come up in the business.
Did you make relationships in those days that are still useful today?
I'm still friends with probably half of them. That is the half of them that stayed in academics and became more famous, and quite a few of us actually did. Not all with monkeys. Some work with rodents, some work with children. But there's a group of us from that time period who all came up as a cohort together.
Okay.
And it's set the stage for me to then come to Wisconsin as an associate professor, since I already was an assistant professor. When I came here, I was blessed one more time and came in at the associate professor level with tenure and jumped over what for many people is a huge hurdle, a nightmarish experience. I was spared that. One more time, the gods shone on me, and I segue into the next point in my career without having to struggle up the tenure ladder. I came in tenured.
Before we begin exploring your time at Wisconsin, what are you doing research-wise at Stanford? How is your research career developing and evolving?
Well, there were several. Do we have time on this tape for me to answer?
I think what I'm going to. This concludes side 2 of tape 1.
And Stanford, Palo Alto was much smaller than that was.
This is tape number 2, side 1 of the ongoing interview with Professor Christopher Coe. Chris, I was just asking you about the development and evolution of your research career at Stanford.
So, as I mentioned earlier, the purpose of going out to Stanford was to learn how to do hormone research, and I did.
Uh-huh.
And I carried out a number of studies on not just stress hormones, but reproductive hormones. I helped this fellow, Seymour Levine, build a monkey lab. So that was an important formative experience as well, because he didn't have one, and so we literally created a whole building. I learned how to build monkey facilities, which was a skill that came in handy when I got to Wisconsin. A few years into that experience, there was a chimpanzee facility at Stanford that lost its director, and so they were looking around for someone to run the chimpanzee facility. So for 2 years, I got to work with chimpanzees and run this chimp facility, which was also a very interesting and important experience. But the last part of my time there is actually what probably had the greater influence in the long run, which is having now worked with Seymour Levine for 6 years, it was beginning to become important for me to differentiate myself some from his work, because although I had an assistant professor title, it was difficult not to be under his shadow to a certain degree. And with his blessing, I was allowed and encouraged to start really moving off on my own. And to do that, I expanded what I was working on to include the immune system and immune measures. And that was the beginning. That was just the start of a new field, a new discipline called psychoneuroimmunology, which was the link between psychology,
behavior, the brain, hormones, and the immune system. And so by the early 80s, I switched my outcome measures from just measuring stress and hormones to learning how to measure immune outcome measures. I sort of almost did a quickie postdoc retraining. I went to an immunologist on campus and asked if I could, in a sense, learn at his chair immunology, really at his bench. And I spent a year learning how to do basic immunology. And so by the time I make the move to Wisconsin, I now identify myself as a psychoneuroimmunologist. And that's still the area that I work in to this day, 20 years later, in one way or another, linking disease, linking the environment, linking behavior, emotions to immune responses or immune diseases.
Now, what was it about the immune system that attracted you?
Part of it was very pragmatic. I needed to find a related area of science that would give me some breathing space, allow me to differentiate myself from this more senior professor who was much more famous. That was just the practical part of it. The specific turning point was a lecture I heard by a man named Robert Ader, and he was studying, was it possible to condition the immune system? Could you behaviorally condition animals or humans to either upregulate or downregulate their immune responses? And the answer is yes, you can, and it's still an interesting and important observation. But it laid the groundwork for, well, if you can condition it, well, how about meditation? How about happiness and sadness? How about diet? How about exercise? How about willing your immune system to get better? Could you do guided imagery or any other kind of mental activity? Once you can condition immune responses, which you can with animals give them food rewards and reward them with food to upregulate an immune response, or you could use negative stimuli, reinforcement, and get them to lower immune responses. Anyway, I heard that lecture, I thought, that's the most unbelievable thing. After all, these are white blood cells just floating around your body. How could you possibly condition a white blood cell to go up or down in its responses? It's still a bit of a puzzle to this day in terms of how it actually happens, but we know it goes through the brain, through hormones, through the nervous system, to the white blood cells, and the answer is yes. You can get rather dramatic changes up and down in immunity that way. I heard that lecture and that sealed my fate. Uh-huh. That was the last of the serendipity circumstance. From then on, it was much more calculated in terms of what I was going to do and what I have been doing.
And this is jumping ahead, but I take it that you've been very content intellectually to have settled into the immune system.
It was a great choice. The best,
mm-hmm.
looking back on it.
Yeah.
It was professionally a good choice. It's done well for me, I mean, in terms of giving me a certain degree of fame. In time, we created a society which was called the Psychoneuroimmunology Research Society, which still exists. Back then, there weren't enough people working in the area to have a society, but there are now. In time, I became the president of that society. I've hosted a meeting of that society here in town. I'm hosting it again next year. So it's been good for me professionally, intellectually. I still think it's the most exciting area of psychology, certainly of health psychology, to work in. It requires knowing everything. You have to know about the environment, you have to know about the individual, you have to know about emotions, and for me, most importantly, it means I have to know about the brain, the endocrine system, and the immune system. It's everything I learned when I was in graduate school. So it's sort of the culmination of a lifetime of learning, and the ultimate nature-nurture question, mind-body area to be in.
Now, Chris, I've forgotten whether at the time that you made that decision, was the AIDS epidemic out or not out?
I switched into the field, this was early 80s, and so the first AIDS cases were 81.
So what really drove the funding for this field of psychoneuroimmunology was the beginning of the AIDS epidemic,
mm-hmm.
and the realization we needed to learn a lot more about the immune system. We needed to learn much more about the relationship between behavior and health, behavior and immunity. How important was stress? Suppose you have a virus like the HIV virus. Could stress make it worse? Would it help to have positive thoughts? Would it matter if you were fatalistic or optimistic? So those were all research questions which yes. are really at the heart of psychoimmunology and still are. And those are still the kind of questions people study now. Why do optimists live longer? Why is it bad to be stoic and not be able to express your emotions? Those are the kinds of research questions people in my area study. I think they're just as fascinating now, 23 years later, as the day I switched into the field. When I started, it was just stress. I mean, when I first, could stress affect the immune system? That's what I worked on initially, but now I work on many other things beyond. Stress is just one facet of what I work on now.
Now, how many years are you doing this at Stanford?
Not that long. I probably first switched, I was at Stanford for a number of years, but the switch to psychoimmunology, or PNI, as it's abbreviated, was not about 83. So I had just been moving into that area when the job opportunity opened here. They were looking for someone to direct the HoloLab. There weren't that many people who had the right credentials. This was a big organization. It's an expensive organization. It needed somebody who could run a large primate lab, but also had a scientific program that justified a large primate lab. To be honest, I didn't quite realize what I was getting into in terms of the scope of it until I got here, in terms of how big it is and how expensive it was. But there weren't that many people back then who could do it, and there are even fewer now who could replace me. In terms of, you had to know how to build a primary facility, run one. You had to have the grantsmanship ability to write grants big enough to justify the existence. And you also had to have research questions that could benefit from the availability of a program with 500 monkeys, and that's big.
Did the UW come looking for you, or did you become aware of this position?
Again, I have been blessed. So they came looking for me. There was a professor here, Chuck Snowden, who is still here in psychology, and he knew of me at Stanford. We had met and all that, and so he facilitated the recruitment.
Uh-huh.
I assume there were other people they interviewed and looked at as well, but in this case it was another one of these handshakes, in the sense that he asked me if I would be interested, would I want to apply. I applied, and then the rest is history.
And you just did talk a little bit about the scope of the operation here. What was the primary draw to leave Stanford and to come here?
Well, that was also a mixed bag. So there was without a doubt the opportunity to help run. I didn't know I would become, in a sense, the exclusive director. I thought it would be more help run the Hollow Primate Lab. Back then and even now, very few universities would build a monkey lab of this type. So that was a rare, a unique opportunity to come and participate in that. I was aware that the University of Wisconsin was a highly regarded school. And so that was a draw, obviously. But beyond that, there were personal reasons. I had two little kids, a three-year-old and a three-month-old.
Yeah.
I knew that Madison would be a good place to raise a family, and it was. And beyond that, my wife and I sat down with a map of the country, and we put X's to all the places we would not want to live. And there were huge regions that we X'd out. There were certain cities we X'd out. And by the time we got done with all the X's on the map, I turned to my wife and I said, "We're moving to Madison, Wisconsin." Between the opportunities and the relatively limited number of places I had left that we wanted to raise a family in,
or live in culturally. Madison seemed like a very good choice. And it was.
Was your wife from California?
She grew up in New York City as well.
Oh.
But we were already married in California, obviously, with kids. But we had met, we were a lab romance in New York.
Oh, interesting. So, okay.
So the reasons to come to Madison were the primate lab, good school, and family reasons, personal reasons.
In view, one of the issues that you had to deal with later in your career here are the animal rights activist people. Was that an issue at that time in Stanford? And did you have a sense that it might become a problem here?
It had already started, it being the animal rights movement. But in the whole time I was at Stanford, I think there was one protest, and when I say protest, on the order of a dozen individuals.
Uh-huh.
I was certainly aware of the animal rights movement. It was growing. It had sort of started to blossom in the mid-70s. So, but on the Stanford campus itself, we really weren't subjected to it, just in part because of the way that the geography of the campus, and it just wasn't a quorum of animal rights people to start a movement. So it wasn't until I got to Madison, but even then, in the first couple of years, there wasn't much of a movement in Madison either. That came a little bit later. It wasn't that there weren't already people opposed to animal research, there were. And in fact, the anti-vivisectionist movement really goes back to the 1800s, mm-hmm. and sort of has ebbed and flowed and come and gone, and there were periods of time, like in 1915, for example, when it actually was quite strong, the anti-vivisectionist movement. So it may be almost as strong as it is now. And then it depends, it comes and goes, depending on what other issues are on the table in the society to have to deal with. So, for example, for the moment, today it's a little less than it was maybe 5 years ago. I mean, with all of us worried about global warming and Iraq and North Korea,
mm-hmm.
we're less focused on, you know, the care of animals and research labs. But I certainly was aware of it.
Uh-huh.
I certainly was aware of the ethical issues related to animal research. And I can say with a little bit of pride that the HoloLab was one of the first to have an ethical charter for the care and use of animals at the facility, way before it was a requirement, way before anybody even thought about having statements like that. So already in the 70s, there is...
Oh, before you're here.
Yeah, but I certainly substantiated when I got here. I mean, I tinkered with the wording some, but we still to this day have a charter that sort of sets some boundary limits, some guidelines in terms of the animals should be cared for humanely. One should minimize distress. One shouldn't use animals cavalierly for no reason.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's also much more regulated, so we don't, in a sense, need that charter. But we had the charter and the principles in place already before we reached the stage of regulation. Now it's done by proclamation. You have a protocol that you submit, it gets approved and all of that. But I actually prefer the idea of ethical principles guiding it. I mean, it's great that we have laws and regulations, but I think it's even more important that we have ethical principles that tell us what to do and not to do.
What's it like when you get here, both in the Department of Psychology and here at the laboratory? What are the issues?
Different than I thought it was going to be, which is always true. So I described it a few minutes ago as participating in the running of the lab. I didn't quite know exactly how the department administered the lab. There were other researchers who worked with monkeys, and I thought I would sort of team up with them, and it would sort of be a more of a cooperative.
Uh-huh.
What I was not expecting was, on arriving, going into the chair's office and being told, "Congratulations, you're the director of the HoloLab." Was nice, sort of, maybe. It was sort of a surprise that he was using the word director. I mean, that I would, the other folks therefore would, I'm saying, there was a committee, but that I was sort of the final authority. But the next thing he dropped on me, I didn't know it all about. I had forgotten to ask such a thing. He said to me, "Oh, and the HoloLab is $26,000 in the hole. Its expenses are exceeding its revenue, and You have 1 year to turn that around, or else the department and the university will probably have to shut the Hollow Lab down. So that was the other shoe. So after the compliment of congratulations, we're naming you the director. You now have the responsibility of financially turning the place around and making it solvent again.
Who was chair at that time?
A man named Len Ross, who subsequently left.
Oh.
And he had some ambivalent feelings about the lab. There were always some status issues related to the lab's autonomy, because we're three blocks down the street, we're in a separate building, and there was always some issue about, are we really a subunit? Are we really our own entity? What is the relationship between Hollow and psychology administratively? I mean, obviously we're a part of psychology, but to a large extent, we also run independently. We have our own mail, we have our own photocopier, we have our own budget,
uh-huh.
Separate from psychology. And as I discovered that morning, that budget wasn't doing so well. The cost of caring for monkeys was exceeding the revenue, and I was told to set it up on more of a business model, so that the revenue coming in would equal the expenditures going out. And that meant coming up with contracts, coming up with grants, ensuring that people paid for things that they got from us. We have what's called a per diem structure, so when you use a monkey in a project, you have to pay for it each day it's in the study.
Oh, I see.
Back then it was $2 a day, now it's $7 a day. But it meant that there couldn't be any hanky-panky. So if somebody used a monkey, they had to pay every single day. They couldn't say, oh, I didn't start the study until next week, when they really had moved the monkey already today. And so what I ended up doing that first year, in part because of the experience out in California, was setting the lab up on much more of a business model, which is the way it runs to this day. It also meant that I myself had to raise the revenue that I was expecting others to put in. And so that first year, I think I wrote 3 grants. So I came here, I was prepping new classes that I'd never taught before. I had
two little kids. Did you have a full teaching load?
Yeah, unlike the softies today, where these young assistant professors come in and say, oh, I can't teach the first semester, or I need a reduced load of 1 class in my first year, or whatever. We taught a full 2-course load every semester, or you bought your way out with grant money. Unlike now, where we soften the entrance and with the expectation that they're going to have to write grants and articles and all of that, and that the first year is going to be difficult. The startup package now compared to then, I was given what was considered the largest startup package of its day in psychology. Startup meaning they gave me a cash fund to work with of $15,000. That was
to support your research, and
that was everything. That was to buy equipment, anything I needed, to pay for a technician, a student hourly, if I wanted to use a little for summer salary or whatever. That was it, and that was considered huge. People in the department were so amazed that I got $15,000. So I had to buy a centrifuge with that, a refrigerator, because I was doing physiology kinds of research.
Yes.
So I had no equipment to speak of, and so that was everything. I bought a centrifuge, a refrigerator, a freezer, test tubes, syringes, I hired a half-time technician. And that was it. That was how I got started.
Now, Chris, I want to make sure I understand. You come in 1985, presumably the summer, and that fall, you're director of the lab, and you're teaching, and you're conducting your research program?
And getting a grant in for October 1, yeah. And February 1. And June 1. Yeah.
That's
the
a
good
pretty,
old days when
that's
things
a pretty
were
major
tough.
Load.
Yeah, we walked through the snow 10 miles uphill both ways. Yeah, no, it was hard. Now, when I listen to the assistant professor's bitch about how hard it is now, you should have been back then. You know, when I say write grants, I mean, we didn't have the kind of computer support and all of that, you know, that we have now. I mean, in truth, it wasn't quite as competitive, but on the other hand, it was quite competitive. The funding wasn't that easy to come by back then.
Maybe we could get you to talk a bit. We'll return to your research. What were you teaching? What were the students like? Did you like it? I know we'll get to the point that you get a teaching award, the Chancellor's Teaching Award, which is quite a significant accomplishment. But what was it like?
Well, prepping classes is not easy. It's hard work. And so that was hard. I mean, although I had taught at Stanford, it wasn't what I did regularly, nor had I really prepped in the sense of I certainly didn't have notes, lecture notes, or even the, you know, illustrations or whatever, although back then we didn't have the kind of PowerPoint and all of that we use now. But so that was hard. I had to prep classes. I was lucky that the department let me teach classes that I knew something about. Many people would come in back then and they might teach intro psych and didn't know whole sections of intro psych that they would have to teach. In my case, I inherited a class called Animal Behavior, the Primates.
Mm-hmm.
It was sort of a class that was famous at Wisconsin because of where the mecca for monkey research. And it was on the curriculum already. It was in the timetable back then. And so I inherited that class. And as I realized when I started to teach it a few weeks ago, I have taught that class for 21 years in a row now.
Wow.
So this is my 21st time through since I started. That was one of the classes I prepped and built, and if you will, I sort of bought and inherited, but then molded it to my own sort of topic areas and all of that in that first year.
Was that a course for majors primarily, or?
The psych department has three tiers of classes. We have what are called level one, which include classes like intro psych. Then there are level two classes, which includes experimental design, statistics, and this class. It's sort of still introductory overview about animal behavior. And then there are the level three classes, which are more seminar specialty classes.
Okay.
And so that first year I also taught those. I taught those level three specialty classes, a class, appropriately enough, that I entitled Psychobiology of Stress and Coping.
Uh-huh.
And again, that's still a class that I frequently teach. Obviously, I've updated the material a lot since 85, but it's the topic area is still relevant today. People still experience stress. People still have to cope with stress. We all experience stress-related disease, heart disease, ulcers. So I still teach that same class. But again, I did have to prep that first year. And so, that was a busy first year.
You must have had both an affinity for teaching and liked it, you know, in view of your subsequent success.
It got easier over time. I was okay at it in the beginning. I think I've gotten better at it, certainly more comfortable being in front of the room. I think I've learned the gift of the gab more than I had back then. In part, it's battlefield training when you have to go up and lecture, do a power lecture for 75 minutes, and you've only had a half hour that day to rehearse, to look at your notes. Do that for 21 years and you get better at extemporaneous speaking. It's been actually very helpful when I go off to meetings, professional. People will often say, oh, you must teach undergrad, you know, because of the way you outline things, certainly the kind of visual illustrations I use, the way I might build a story up from A to B to C to D. The undergraduate teaching has been very helpful, but I wouldn't say I was an instant success and an instant natural teacher. That came through hard work.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, and as a kid, I had some speech issues where I stuttered and swallowed the ends of words, which I still sometimes lapse and do now.
Huh.
And so it's kind of amazing, given that, as I think about it sometimes, that I ended up in a profession where I should have to talk so much, whether it be to this tape recorder or to the media or to students, because early on, speaking in this way was not easy. And even now what I do is I slow down my speech to not stumble over the end of a word or to stutter and repeat a part of a syllable.
Interesting. Now, when you started encountering undergraduates here, did they compare favorably or unfavorably to your experience at Stanford?
I can contrast them both to Stanford and to growing up in New York. In New York, students are much more adversarial. You challenge the professors. Certainly, when I was in college in the late 60s, early 70s, you challenged everything the professor said, even when it was a fact. Where did you get that from? Why do you believe that? You know, that was just assumed that you would have that kind of intellectual tension in the classroom. None of that in UW. We still don't have that. Uh-huh. The Midwestern student doesn't challenge the professor. I occasionally have a student who challenged me. I have one in my class. It just happened this week. I had showed an old movie, and the guy who was delivering the monologue spoke of humans as man, the way they used to back then. Used to talk about, and our species was man the hunter. And so I had a woman challenge, why did I even use a film where they would use, I said I couldn't edit it out. I mean, that's the way they spoke back then. I said, it's interesting, actually, as a historical piece, that we've come so far that we would look for a gender-neutral term like human rather than man. But it's rare to get a student in the Midwest who would question your use of a video clip were a topic area, whereas when I growing up in New York, that was the mode. You would always challenge your professors. You asked about comparing them to Stanford. The difference at Stanford is, and certainly was true then, all the kids were brilliant, incredibly smart, elite group of students, especially at that time period when I was there. Now it may be a little more mixed. So what I describe about UW, it's, do I have time for one last thought?
Yes, you do.
And it's a pretty common way to describe our students. The best of our students are as good as anywhere, but you also get a lot of other students. A lot of average ones, ones who don't know why they're at university. They're just here because it was the next thing to do, or because they heard it was a party school, or their friend went here. Or they live in Wisconsin, so they go to Madison. Whereas, in contrast to the Stanford students, and there they were, really elite, incredibly smart.
This concludes side one of tape two. This is side two of tape two of the ongoing oral history interview with Professor of Psychology Christopher Coe. Chris, you were talking about the quality of the students in response to my question. Let me switch the attention for a moment onto the history of the department at this time. What was the department like? What were the issues there? Who were some of the key faculty at the time you came?
So the Department of Psychology here is one of the older departments in the country.
Really?
Yeah. I think it was... Maybe wrong on the actual number, but I wanted to say it could have possibly been the second earliest department of psychology in the country. UW had early on, I could be off on the exact number, but it was definitely one of the earliest. And it was highly regarded already by the 30s, certainly by the 50s. It was definitely well regarded when I came in the 80s. There had been quite a few senior influential people, including this fellow, Harry Harlow, who many consider among the most important comparative psychologists of the last century. I guess I would describe it as a highly regarded department with some renowned individuals, and they succeeded at the time when I was coming in the mid-80s, because of that reputation, in bringing in a whole young generation of people who would grow up together, become successful together. And so my cohort that I came with, that I think of as people who arrived in the early 80s through the late 80s, almost every single one has, in their respective fields within psychology, has gone on to become very successful.
Have most of them stayed here?
It's been a mixed bag. Some have stayed. So Richard Davidson, for example, is still here, and he came at that time. Carol Riff came at that time, and she's still here. So some are still here. But there were others who, because they became successful here, were wooed away.
Mm-hmm.
And as we like to say about all of those who leave, they still did their best work of their whole career while they're here, and that they then dropped after leaving. And actually, that's only half apocryphal. Quite a few of them actually did do their best work here and then really have rested more on their laurels after arriving at other institutions. And I don't know whether that's just because of the nature of what happens when you move later in your career, or whether there just was a good chemistry here, both within the department and across departments, which enabled people to do their best work while they were here. For me, this has been a great academic institution to do research.
Now, you said earlier that you were happy to come to Wisconsin.
Oh, yeah.
That you knew it was a good step. You know, leaving the delights of California aside, I take it was not difficult to choose on an intellectual basis to leave Stanford to come here because of the strengths of the department.
Not at all, no. And although I didn't appreciate it at the time, there were some real benefits of moving from a med school psychiatry department, which is what I was in at Stanford, to a more academic social sciences department like psychology. It makes a big difference when there's undergraduate teaching. It makes a big difference when there are grad students versus postdocs and staff. So when you're in a med school department, you don't really have a lot of undergrads around you. You don't have a lot of graduate students around you. The people tend to be a bit more senior, and they're further along, and more workers rather than students. And so I really like being in an academic department, and that was the right place for me to land. And so coming to psychology was great.
You didn't feel like being in an academic department was going to hurt your research with the...
Just meant I had to work harder for me. And it's still true. It's a challenge, especially now we're hitting another period where it's very competitive to get grant money. And you are a bit at a disadvantage if you have a heavy teaching load, because you're competing head-to-head with somebody who might not teach at all or might teach two lectures a year. And yet you're still expected to write the same quality papers, the same number of papers. The way I handle that is I just outwork the competition. I just work longer days than they do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, meaning that I incorporate teaching and administration and do research. But you don't get any chips, any kudos for being a teacher. When your grant goes in, you get judged solely on the research, the merits of the research proposal. They couldn't care less. If anything, they would probably look down at you for, why are you bothering to teach?
Mm-hmm. When you came to the department in the 80s, was the department a congenial place, a competitive place? What was it like? Were there enough colleagues here to meet your intellectual companionship needs?
I would describe it as more congenial today than it was back then. The people who were a little higher in the hierarchy expected more deference. You had to be deferential to a full professor if you were an assistant professor. We still, as most departments do, have an executive committee, meaning you're a tenured faculty versus non-tenured.
Uh-huh.
Hiring decisions by university bylaw are done only by the tenured faculty. So there's still a bit of that, but it was more so back then.
Uh-huh.
The senior professors were more in charge back then. The particular individuals were more bristly, less supportive. You basically were supposed to make it on your own. You either made it or you didn't make it. Uh-huh. There weren't the kind of things we have now. Mentoring committees for assistant professors, where tenured faculty nurture, meet with the assistant professor, ask them how it's going, What do you need advice on? If their grant gets rejected, review it with them and tell them what to do. You didn't, it was make it or break it back then. And some people did. And those of us who survived the gauntlet were better for it. Adversity builds character. But there were also people who were hurt by that, who could have done better maybe if it was a more supportive environment. So I pretty much arrived here, and I'm not trying to be a modest, but I basically had to make it on my own. Uh-huh. And I even had some additional things, like being told, oh, by the way, that lab you work at is on the verge of bankruptcy. Turn it around financially. So I didn't have to just turn my own research, or not turn my own, I didn't have just have to start my own research, but I also had to undo some damage, financial damage that had been
taken. How did you turn it around financially? I know you talked about the per diem. How did you do it?
It was a mixture of following, I guess, what you would just call sound business principles to bring in as much money as you need to match expenditures. It included getting grants myself, contracts. So in addition to writing research grants, I sold some monkeys as a contract to somebody. I got a contract from NASA to breed monkeys for NASA. So I basically turned a part of it into a business part of the operation.
Uh-huh.
And that still goes on to this day. I mean, we don't have a lot of contracts in that sense, but if somebody were to come to us and say, we need you to create 10 monkeys for us, or we would like to test that new drug we've created, we would then negotiate a relationship. So in addition to this sort of pure exploratory research, basic science research we do, there is a business component of raising the capital, the cash,
mm-hmm.
to run an organization like this. So that was all sort of put in motion in that first year. That's why I described that first year as one very busy year.
Yeah. But you had self-interest. You had to make the lab succeed because you needed it, I assume.
Yeah, and this probably we'll talk about on another day on a different tape, but there was always the option, and there still is the option now, of blending the lab into what's called the Primate Center, which is across the street. UW is very unique with regards to its primate research that it has such a large operation, which we call the primate lab, that's a part of psychology, and in addition has one of the national primate centers. So we're in the Midwest, the home of the regional primate center, and that's right across the street from us.
Mm.
And so there was always the default that, well, if the lab can't manage on its own, it would blend into the center.
I see.
And that still pops up now, and my guess is that that is what will happen. When I retire, my guess is that the lab will probably blend into the center, unless something surprising occurs and they actually recruit another me. Assuming there is another me in the department and person, if that doesn't happen, then my guess is that in 9 years, it will default into the primate center.